Welcome to the Humanist Union of Madison monthly meeting. Our speaker today is Dr. Jane Shoup, who most of you were introduced to this morning. So let her begin.
Well, thank you very much. There's so much to talk about. It's hard to know where to start. But I thought maybe to provoke some comments from you, I would read a couple of short pieces from The Reluctant Mr. Darwin, which I have mentioned to several people. Is of all the books that I know about on Darwin, I think this would have to be my favorite. It's by David Quammen, who's a science writer and has done several very nice pieces in the National Geographic. So each of these quotes from this book raises, a category of questions, I guess you would say. And so I'd like to read all three of them, and then afterwards you can jump in and talk about whatever interests you. The first one refers to the poles, and the question we might ask is, why is it that Americans have, especially Americans, have so much difficulty accepting evolution? Why has the debate persisted so long? And here's what David Quammen has to say. The Gallup organization in November 2004, after more than 1,000 telephone interviews, found that 45% of the respondents agreed with the statement, God created human beings pretty much in their present form at one time within the last 10,000 years or so. For short, creationism. That's 45%. Another statement offered alternatively said that humans have developed over millions of years from less advanced forms of life, but God guided the process. For short, theistic evolution. That option satisfied 38% of the people polled, so I think we're up to about 82%. Just 13% agreed with a statement that humans have developed from other forms of life without guidance by God. For short, materialistic evolution. And the remainder had no classifiable opinion. For short, go away, we're watching TV. Okay, so we might think about that for a little bit. And then the next question is, refers more to moderate religionists, I think, not to so much to the people who subscribe to literal interpretation of the Bible, but the ones that we think of as more moderate. And this falls under the category of what has been called human exceptionism, meaning that evolution applies to everything else, but humans are a little different. Okay, and so what Common has to say about that. The existence of God, any sort of God, personal or abstract, immanent or distant, is not what Darwin's evolutionary theory challenges. What it challenges is the supposed godliness of man, the conviction that we, above all other life forms, are spiritually elevated, divinely favored, possessed of an immaterial and immortal existence, immortal essence, such that we have special prospects for eternity, special status in the expectations of God, special rights and responsibilities on earth. That's where Darwin runs afoul of Christianity, Judaism, Islam, and probably most other religions on the planet. And then he goes on, and I read this during the service, but I'll read it one more time because it's kind of related. Scientific insight and religious dogma had never come more directly into conflict. It was a bigger issue than whether humans and monkeys share a common ancestry. It was the issue of whether humans and monkeys, along with lobsters and dandelions and all other living creatures, share an absence of special divine appointment. In plain language, a soul or no soul, a life, an afterlife or not, are humans spiritually immortal in a way that chickens and cows aren't, or just another form of temporarily animated meat? So that's that anthropocentric bias of most religious views about man's place in nature. And then the third area, this speaks to some of the environmental issues and how an evolutionary way of thinking affects how we behave toward the environment. And again, it's related to that idea of human exceptionalism. And I think it asks some questions or raises some questions that might be bothersome to humanists. Nature's real order isn't peaceable. It's a desperate scramble, even when the desperation is muted and obscure. Darwin alludes to a famous statement made by a Swiss botanist suggesting that all nature is at war, one organism with another, or with external nature. Predation, competition, parasitism, overcrowding. As species continue to procreate, there just isn't enough food or enough space for their offspring. Reproductive rates are geometric. Habitat is finite. Fortunately, many dangers loom. If struggle and death didn't sweep away most individuals of most species, the lands, seas, and skies would be impossibly full. Humans are relatively slow breeders, but the arithmetic holds true even for us. If we all bred and survived, doubling our population every generation, within a few thousand years, there wouldn't be standing room for another person on the planet. Elephants breed even more slowly, but their inherent rate of increase is geometric too. A single female elephant, if she produced just 6 offspring in her lifetime, and if every descendant reproduced similarly, would in 5 centuries, according to Darwin's rough calculation, yield a population of 15 million. That's a lot of elephants. Too many. It doesn't happen. Why not? Because every elephant must struggle to survive, to reproduce, and many fail. So, as humanists, I think that gives us a challenge. We can't really escape natural selection, and we certainly have overpopulated the planet. And so, how do you feel about that as humanists?
I have an opinion. Mm-hmm. I did not put a sticker in my driver's license to get organs because I'm thinking I myself would refuse to have an organ transplant. I think we're keeping ourselves alive too long, keeping everybody alive, we're keeping babies that would never have made it alive, and elderly people much longer. Mm-hmm. And we're overpopulating faster and faster.
Mm-hmm. Mary, have a hand up.
I think that we have to act as if there's human exceptionalism because the humans are the ones who have the rational minds and can bring rational solutions to bear on some of these problems. Certainly, human population can be controlled. If conditions are right, kind of, and women are educated and there's enough to go around, families will be limited. And maybe not enough, but we can deal with these problems, whereas in the rest of the natural kingdom, those things are rather inevitable, I agree.
We have the ability to separate our sexuality from procreation.
And also, how can we preserve the environment if we don't consider ourselves responsible for it? That's the Unitarian view. In most liberal religions, we are stewards of the planet, whether we call it God's planet or the planet.
We won't have time.
Jennifer?
Studies have shown that if women are educated and birth control is available, the women will limit the reproduction. I mean, even to the point that in places like Italy and Israel, the government is giving incentives for having children because women aren't having enough women are not having enough to repopulate without the immigration. And there are a lot of, controversies about that because they're saying that, this says that Italian women or Italian people are better than the immigrants that are coming in and they want to keep it Italian. But I mean, it does show that it is naturally, I mean, humans with reason can limit the reproduction and will if given the opportunity.
There was something on the news just a couple of days ago that said Japan was doing the same thing, trying to encourage women to have babies because their population has decreased so much. And they're pretty ethnocentric in that they don't have a very large immigrant population. So there's nobody there to take care of the elderly because they're not reproducing them.
They don't allow much immigration.
They don't allow
right.
much immigration.
Yeah. Well, that's a whole other issue that we could talk about here. But, you know, there's a larger question. You know, you talk about these countries have limited, are limiting their population to some extent, but the world is not. And right now there's 6.7 billion people, and the UN projections say 9 billion by the middle of the century. I don't think we'll achieve that. And the reason is that we're confronted.
Maybe not the word.
Yeah. The reason is, well, you're all aware of just tremendous problems. And the financial thing is only one aspect of the difficulties we encounter. But Jane and I are doing a course. We're involved in a life program up at the University of Wisconsin-Stevens Point. It's for people like us. And people
life,
like
life meaning what? L-I-F-E.
Life means learning is forever. It means and the people that present courses are people like us and the faculty members there and others. I mean, it runs the range from philosophy courses, the kinds of things that we do, to learning how to cook wild game, to attending plays, and anyway, it's a wonderful program. But we're doing a course on how would you phrase it, living within limits, a new paradigm. And the news is not good. The projections are not good. When you factor in things not only like the financial problems, but more so than that, the question of oil diminishing. You know, the curve on oil production is like this and like this. We're going to be over that peak if we're not over it now, which means that it's going to have a devastating effect on society because everything in the world runs on oil. Global warming is another issue. It's just a article in the paper yesterday, I think it was, and on the news was that a lot of scientists now feel it's irreversible. The damage has been done and we can't reverse it. Which means that temperatures will rise, the weather patterns change, and the big problem is food production. If you don't have oil, you can't produce food. If, just as an example, on your plate, one item, one unit of energy that you get from the food you eat, 10 units of energy from oil went into that, producing that unit and the farming of it. We literally eat oil, and it's running out. So the century ahead looks very, I hate to say depressing, but it does, and I'm kind of glad I'm at the age I am, because I'm not sure what the future entails. But that's the real problem. And this is a problem, you know, there's an article, this one fellow, a lot of analysts looking at this thing, and he says in this century, 4 billion people will perish above and beyond normal mortality because of lack of food, starvation, disease, and a lot of these people feel it's inevitable.
There's another one. As global warming increases, the land mass is going to diminish because of water rises.
Well, there's so many things. I'm doing a section on inconvenient truths. Global warming, as Al Gore presented, is only one. Deforestation, peak oil, desertification, spreading of deserts. Fresh water around the world is a critical resource now. All these things are the loss of forests, all of them just critical problems. So we're moving in that direction, and it's just very difficult, and the projections, as I say, are not good. Well, it raises an issue for humanists. You know, the table is turned, and the situation is different. There's way too many of us. And maybe if 4 billion have to die, mm-hmm. we're as humanists, we're compassionate. We seek to preserve life and make things easier. But as Ferdinand I, who was a Holy Roman Emperor, said, Let justice be done, though the world perish. Let justice be done, though the world perish. Well, for an ecologist, that's not right. That's not acceptable. There's too many of us. Now, how do we bring it into balance? And it's a problem if you're a humanist. I'd struggle with this thing. I don't know what's... and I'd be interested in what you're... Marcia.
Yeah. I'd like to talk about population control. And I hope this won't sound frivolous. I don't mean it to. There is a point I want to make. I have 5 cats. I rescued at one time or another each of the 5 from a very overcrowded shelter. They're all females. The first thing I did with each cat was to have her spayed. Now, Dave and I really enjoy these 5 cats. 5 seems like a lot, it is. But can you imagine what the cat population at our place would be after, and this has been 4 years, if each cat would have had 5 or 6 kittens several times a year. Now what I feel is because I, as human, have the knowledge and the help to be able to limit each cat's ability to reproduce, I not only saved myself a lot of grief because nobody wants to drown kittens, but I think I avoided for small creatures, many, many small creatures, a life of real suffering. Because obviously I couldn't take care of all those cats, and I don't think anyone could. So because they never came into existence, I feel I have avoided that suffering. I think population control is important, and I think we as humans have the science to be able to do whatever we can to limit it, whereas animals just have no ability at all. And what happens in the animal world is that when there are too many of them, they die because of starvation or all kinds of other things that go with overcrowding and overpopulation, and that's just pure suffering for so many that wouldn't be necessary if they could control their numbers.
Do you think we're each entitled to 5 cats?
Well, listen, I know, if you're interested, I know where I can get you some.
I had a cat when I was a child before people worried about this kind of thing, and she had 64 kittens in her life. And I couldn't keep her unless I found them all homes. Back then, wow. I wasn't that bad.
Rosemary,
64.
As a humanist, I was turned onto this problem many years ago when Dr. Paul Ehrlich wrote The Population. Well, mm-hmm. In fact, I wrote a little talk on that from my then Unitarian group. And as a humanist, I think that we really need to focus on birth control and population control. And to the point that I almost sympathize with what the Chinese did. That was over the top, of course. But, you know, as long as we have had governments, we've had 8 years of this idiotic kind of government, that will not allow help to African and underdeveloped countries because they include in their health programs abortion and population control. Nothing is going to happen. And I think now, maybe with the new government, we could or we should become the sort of the pioneers of spreading birth control in overpopulated outlying countries. But of course, then you run into ideological problems. I remember some time ago that when the big debate was going on about birth control and stuff, there were certain factions among the African American community who were saying this is a
genocide
plot by the white ruling powers and blah blah blah. You all know what I'm talking about. So you're going to run into that, but I think for the better sake of everyone, we have to face those kind of things. And I'm with Menchie in that respect also. If you keep on artificially prolonging life, I think we should use all of our knowledge to prevent suffering and pain and debilitating things, but not necessarily, you know, it's great that your mother was 104,
She didn't need any life support.
She didn't need and that's great, but you know, this artificial stuff is really totally counterproductive to humanity.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's my opinion.
There's a woman, well-known woman right now with 6 children, where the state is taking care of 8 more that she has just birthed, and at a tremendous financial and resource cost. But who's to make the choice of, do I want to sterilize my own child so that she can't give me grandchildren? I mean, you know, we take care of cats, perhaps, but let's bring it to ourselves. And how do we make those choices?
Education.
It's got to be education.
Well, education. I don't think anybody can accuse you of overpopulating.
No.
How's education?
Someone in the back there.
I think that you can say education, but
that is
we're a long way from educating the world to stop procreating.
And who are we to say?
Yeah.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And I think so.
Kathy had her hand up.
I think you're making a mistake in dismissing low fertility in large areas of the world and rapidly declining the fertility of other parts. So essentially all of Europe is below, has fertility below the replacement level. And in countries like Russia, it's really significantly below. Well, Russia, Spain, Italy, and Korea and Japan have below replacement fertility. And countries like Korea and Japan illustrate how rapidly things can change in less than a generation.
In developed countries.
What?
In developed countries it can change, but it doesn't seem to change in the undeveloped.
That's right.
Yeah.
And so development gets mixed up with this, but fertility, low fertility is a problem in Russia or Italy or Spain.
After hearing Rick speak, I'm just appalled at the thought that maybe you thought I meant we should go and sterilize people.
No, I'm just
I never meant that,
that
for
it leads us to that, though. It's the cats aren't the real problem.
Well, there's a big difference, though, between that and just limiting. I mean, limiting the number. Saying to ourselves, well, 2 or 3 children is probably enough. Can we live with that?
At least too many.
Did our speaker have a word in here?
We got a point that wants to be made from the back right there.
Poor Kathy.
Well, I was going to say, I agree that women education is important, but I don't think it's a factor of income, I don't think it's a factor of education, because if you look in the United States, it is a growing and very present trend. The more money you have, the more kids you get to have. And what bothers me is I see very wealthy families having 5, 6, 7, 8 children, and that's fine. But then what happens is they get to say, people who, you've got to be very careful, because it's okay if you've got plenty of money, you can have as many kids as you want, and that's not the attitude that we need to have in this country, but we do. I mean, if you do much flying and traveling in airports, it's amazing how many families you see with 5 and 6 and 7 and 8 kids, and they're all little kids, and they obviously have enough money that they can fly out. They've just been off to the Bahamas or someplace. So I think we've got to find some way to look at from a perspective that is equitable. Do we say to a poor family, you can't have children because you can't afford it, therefore you have to have one, but I make plenty so I can have 6. So we've got to get past that in this country. In this country, I think it's one of the biggest offenders on too many children.
Let me address that from Allied Drive Food Pantry. You'd also be surprised how many people come through there and only have 1 child or 2 children. I'm just amazed. I expected when we went there, there would be big families. It's not. And sometimes you take, if they have 6, it's somebody, some woman that's taking care of her grandchildren or taking care of somebody else. And I think that as far as population control, if you came down and just looked at the thing and said, human beings are taking up too much resources on the planet. Who should we get rid of? Well, it'd be us. Because we're the people. If you eliminate one of us, you eliminate a hell of a lot more than if you eliminate 10 Bengalis.
Yeah.
And so if you look at it that way, then maybe you don't want to look at it at all.
It's also a question of preconception. I mean, I had a hysterectomy before I was 30. In my case, it was because of cancer. But I start mentioning that, I still get looks of pity in certain crowds. There is this attitude that the woman's ability to have kids...
Completes her.
Yes, completes her. That's the way to put it, you know. Yeah. And if anybody would actually choose to have a hysterectomy, I mean, it's the same with a man, and what I forget what that's called, but
vasectomy,
yeah. It's to be weird.
Sterilization is not a big deal. I had it after three kids, and I should have maybe had it earlier.
I had it also. It's called. I had it also, and it's called conversion of a family sedan to a sport coupe.
There is that preconception out there. I can see it frequently.
I was thinking that maybe we need to look at it from a little bit different perspective and ask the question, how many people can the Earth support at a reasonable standard of living? How many people can this country support at a reasonable standard of living? If we come from that direction, there's been a number of people, Ehrlich is one, who made some judgment about how many... what was a sustainable human population. And I think maybe the most prominent person is David Pimentel at Cornell University, who's an agricultural economist, I believe. And his estimate is somewhere between 1 and 2 billion for the world and maybe 150 million for the United States. So it seems to me that maybe the most productive way to look at this is to say, okay, well, what's the goal? What should we be at? We're at 6.7 billion, but we should be at 2 billion, let's say. And how do we get from here to there? Mm-hmm. And then you get into all these knotty problems about who's going to reproduce and who isn't. And Garrett Hardin has said that, educating women and giving women opportunities is a good step, first step forward. But Hardin says people want too many children. I mean, it's really a biological urge. I mean, that's true of every species. We all want more offspring,
especially like us.
Yeah,
especially ones like us. Yeah.
Jean, but if you're setting that goal of, all right, now we're going to limit the world population to such, if you brought it down a few million more, then you're allowing other creatures of this earth to enjoy the resources of the earth instead of us.
It isn't only us, is it?
And I mean, here's an example of where we always think we come first. Maybe we ought to consider leaving a little more for the other creatures. We destroy their habitat now in many cases because we need houses to live in and so on. And if we just brought that, how far are you going to bring it down and how many other creatures are you going to allow to enjoy the wealth of this earth?
Absolutely.
Just a statistic on that. I've forgotten who the biologist who did this, and I'm not sure exactly how he did this calculation, but 10,000 years ago, his calculation was that human beings, us living, very few of us, hunter-gatherers, represented a tenth of a percent of the, I think, the land vertebrate mass of a biomass on the planet. All the other animals were. Today, man and his animals... His
cats
cows, and... his cats, all the rest of our paraphernalia constitute 98% of vertebrate mass. The change is tremendous, and it's in a minute or two of geological time. It's just beyond belief when you look at that and consider that. And the point I wanted to make was that the things are changing so rapidly. And these climatologists are telling us we don't have much time, a decade maybe, to make changes. And this one study says it's already irreversible, but to make changes. Otherwise, we're going to pass tipping points, and the Earth is going to be much less hospitable, support many fewer animals because of the warming and the rising of seas and all the rest of it. So there isn't much time. And at least the way they say it, and I kind of tend to agree. The more I get into this thing, we've read voluminously on this, and the more you read, I tell you, the more
wake up in the middle of the night and say, what can we do? What can we do?
Yeah.
Literally.
Well, to translate what you just said into plain English, the Chinese have given humanity the best shot, but it was inadequate.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Can you find that Darwin quote, that the quote that Maitland Eddy made on... is it at the end of Blueprints, the one about...
I was going to do that kind of at the end.
Oh, okay, yeah. You were going to do it at the end, yeah.
I had read someplace that that in terms of the bringing the population down, that at this point India is the critical country because of its very huge population. That China is a huge population, but they're heading in the right direction. India is the one...
pay more money
with
have another kid.
All of the poverty, and they have a very, they still are running a pretty, their educated classes are having fewer children, but there's a huge reservoir of poverty where people are having a lot of kids, and they felt that India was the key to that tipping point in terms of population, and that it was sitting, this was a few years ago, and I don't know how it's gone, but that at that point it was sitting on a hair and could go
either way.
And that depending on when it went to lower population was the critical factor in us being able to reverse the population explosion or not.
Well, the projection there is for India is 1.7 billion by 2030. And they'll surpass China as the most populated nation. And it's interesting... With regard to this issue of peak oil, China and India are both coming on. They're developing their countries based on oil and coal, for that matter. But just when these things are running out, they're going to fail. And of course, we're going to fail because we're already on it. We're such an oil dependent country that it's just very difficult. Going to be very, very difficult.
I have a question to you in relation to the thing you're saying about oil. We're using every food we eat. I have this deeply rooted belief that in the end, nature will win out and take
insects.
Over.
Insects will win.
Well, whatever part of nature. To me, it's just plain nature. What if the oil runs out? Then wouldn't the humanity have to go back to a more primitive way of agriculture? And there would be the natural selection. People would die.
That's right.
But in the end, I think we will eventually go back to a simple, more natural way of living, if there's any life left, and start from scratch. I mean, that's my kind of a crazy notion, but that's the way
the
I
forecast is later this century, we'll all be living much more locally, those who are alive, and because oil won't be able to bring in all these supplies from various far parts away. And so, that's very true.
Well, and I think... I've already been trying to change our buying practices, with CSAs and that sort of thing, to as much as possible buy locally.
Yeah.
Tough to get bananas, but...
Yeah. Well, you don't need bananas. We've stopped eating bananas.
You're eating rude beggars, right?
We do need bananas. Yeah. We do eat rude beggars and parsnips and turnips and... at this time of year, but eating seasonally, eating locally, is, you say, well, what can I do? Well, that's a tiny little step, but it is one thing we can do, is try to get as much as we can locally.
I'd like to address the China-India thing, which is interesting, that China is probably the world's biggest communist country, and India is the world's biggest democracy, and yet China has progressed tremendously. And India is not at all.
They burn coal.
Well, sure they burn coal, but I say just looking at those two societies in the two ways, and one of the things is that China is a Confucian country. Mm. And the Confucian countries, Japan, China, Korea, are subject to discipline from the top. Mm-hmm. They will go ahead, and if you tell them we got to do this in order to make our country good, they will. But India is like the United States, just a whole bunch of individuals and unruly. Mm. And so there's a lot of differences there.
I lived in Bangladesh, and I remember, seeing firsthand how poor people can be. We don't even know that kind of poverty, I don't think, in this country, but how poor, really poor people can be. But one of the problems with this overpopulation of a place like Bangladesh other countries will not accept these people across their borders as immigrants. And so as the population gets bigger and bigger, they're more crowded and more crowded. And it seems like, and especially if the sea waters rise, I think, you know, nature has always controlled population where it's had to.
Ultimately.
And unfortunately, that involves all this suffering, all this dying, just to maintain some sort of balance. And if nature doesn't do it, mankind himself, there are studies that show that when there's overcrowding, people can get very vicious to lay claim to their own what little space they have left.
That was one of the explanations.
I wanted to mention one other aspect of poor countries having more children is that the families need the kids to help raise money to feed themselves.
Yeah, it's a vicious cycle.
So few opportunities to raise their own standard of living, so their kids are doing it on the street. Mm-hmm.
Going to Slumdog Millionaire is a good thing to do.
Okay.
A very good thing to do. You see a lot of it.
Okay.
Rose,
yeah.
Thank you. Well, remember Indira Gandhi tried very hard to get population under control in India. And that was one reason she was assassinated.
Mm-hmm.
But also, the Hindu religion promotes sexuality. And I think that's part of the problem there.
Mm-hmm.
What about creationism and their attitude towards population growth? Have you run into populate the earth from the Bible, that sort of thing, as a justification for large families?
I don't hang out with a lot of creationists, but I think, of course, there's people that believe in the rapture, and they don't, you know, I guess that's, they're creationists. And so it doesn't matter, but, you know, we'll...
That would solve a population problem, wouldn't it?
Yeah. That would solve some of them, yeah.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Now, I'd like to get back to kind of the, I don't know if you call it the psychology, but the personal feelings about having children in terms of what was just brought up, needing people, you know, to help with farming or needing people to help with the business, or knowing if you're in a country where there is a lot of child mortality, then you have to have so many kids in order for enough to survive to take care of you. And if that is corrected, and I don't know the history of this, you know, where there has been a reduction of childbirth, but if that is corrected, I would think as a parent, if you would want to be raised, would prefer to raise a minimal group of healthy children than a litter of kids that you're going to watch die and watch live in misery. Just briefly, I mean, I'm into a lot of patient blogs, and people are probably getting tired of hearing me talk about it. I've read a lot about specifics of what's going on throughout Haiti. And, I mean, if there's one miserable country, that certainly...
Oh, it's the worst, yes.
You see pictures of some of these rescue organizations where, you know, they'll lay out a blanket and they'll have maybe 15 babies that have been brought in the course of a couple of days that are, the parents can't take care of them. Some are dying, and then some will die, some will survive. And the mortality of children will be under the age of 15. And I forgot the percentage, but it's a shocking percent of how many died before they ever reached the age of 15. I mean, I, as a mother, would certainly prefer having a smaller...
Who's to change things there?
Well, that's the problem. Is there a change agent? I think there's objection to birth control on the part of... I don't know if the women would object as much. I just don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But I think I'm a part of a lot of the churches that are serving the areas. And this I don't know enough about, but my suspicion is that there are probably a lot of groups that are out there as missionaries that are running. I think most of the orphanages are being run by missionaries.
Yeah.
And my suspicion is that they're close to birth control.
Could we move beyond the topic of population control to the next topic you had in mind?
But It seems to me that an awful lot of people are not motivated by the thinking process that we would recognize. And yeah. I was impressed by Stefan's comment during the presentation. He said about religion, well, some people, in spite of everything, they want to believe in the supernatural. Mm-hmm.
God will provide.
All of their education may have been not encouraging that, and yet, I think also people who don't understand what is causing some things to happen on it, and they come up with a conspiracy theory because they don't understand it, and they think somebody else smarter does, and so on. But I think that the motivation, the change agents, you know, what keeps people from buying big cars is $4 gas. What encourages them to buy more, we'll soon see, if it doesn't change, is $2 gas. Mm-hmm.
They're shutting down the Prius lines right now because mm-hmm. people are buying bigger cars again because mm-hmm. gas prices came down. But how fickle we are.
No, really, I'm not in Europe, though. Mm-hmm. Okay. Far ahead of that.
What's the next subject? What's the next subject? Well, I don't know. I see it as all kind of a piece. But I guess maybe to go to the second reading that I did. That was the one about the place of man or the godliness of man. Mm-hmm. And I guess the question I would throw out is, how does who we think we are and where we came from affect or determine our behavior?
And how is it that
attitude again that we're superior?
Yeah.
I think people's attitude toward animals can be seen. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. if you think you're above everything, you can mistreat an animal because they're, you know, lesser mm-hmm. beings.
Well, there are some evangelicals now. I mean, they do the above thing, but they're doing the we are shepherds of the earth. We have to take care of the animals.
Yeah, there are some. That's right.
Which has gotten the ecological people in not bad, but. Connecting with the evangelicals, mm-hmm. so that doesn't always apply.
Well, it did for many, many years.
Mm-hmm. That's good. Mm-hmm.
And
that's why we have
animals. Well, I mean, those types are more the rapture types who think the world's going to end in 3 days, so we might as well blow the place up.
But yeah, you're right, there's a big ecology movement mm-hmm. among the which yeah. is wonderful. I keep wondering, in terms back to Darwin and evolution and global warming, and how the stressors of global warming will change flora and fauna, and if it's going to happen too. You know, now we know that evolution can be a much more rapid process than Darwin thought in his day. Mm-hmm. And there's been, you know, within just very short amount of subspecies or species generations. Can adapt. And I think it's going to be a very interesting thing since I have a feeling we are stuck with global warming, even if we turn everything off right now.
I mean, there's always the
trouble is it's happening so fast.
Right. Because it's happening so fast, mm-hmm. it's going to, some animals and plants are not going to be able to adapt, but I'm just intellectually curious. And we won't know till we're there.
Like,
as to what's, you know, because of this, that we now know that things can evolve a whole lot faster than we ever thought. It's going to be fascinating to see.
Well, we're in the sixth mass extinction right now.
Yes.
I mean, that's happening. We're right. losing species more rapidly than background rate.
Uh-huh.
And largely because of Have any of you come across a book called The World Without Us?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. By I forgot who.
I saw P. Peterson in there.
Yeah. Anyway, it's kind of a mind experiment. Mm-hmm. He says, imagine for whatever reason the human species disappeared mm-hmm. tomorrow. What would happen? And then he goes on prognosticate about which species would survive and which would not. The first thing that would happen, I think he says, is that Manhattan would resort to a swamp, which is what it originally was.
The waters would come in.
Because they're all the time pumping the water out to maintain the...
Well, it depends on what cataclysm brings about the end of mankind. If it's atomic annihilation, the animals would be annihilated also.
New disease.
Really
true.
Well, never would everything be annihilated. Yeah. So evolution, you know, familiar with the Gaia principle. James Lovelace developed that idea that, and ultimately the Earth, you know, maybe this is a comforting thought. I mean, if we end up destroying most things in so many million years, evolution will take, and we'll have a whole new set of species, and the world will go on like we were never here, and.
Well, the book that Jane was referring to, there's also a film that I saw, and I think that the proposal there was that man would just somehow mysteriously disappear, but everything else was intact, and then what would happen?
Where did we get that? Was that a DVD from the library?
I can't remember. Our son-in-law got us a copy. But I was going to say that, you know, in the whole process of evolution all through the history of the Earth and probably the universe is that there are winners and losers. Mm-hmm. And I think that's inevitable, and we can only guess, for instance, on the flora and fauna, I don't know, maybe some of us, I know I do, kind of wish that there were a little more global warming here so that we could have a longer growing season, be able to get our squash ripe. But
you can get that by moving.
Yeah,
I'm trying to grow some peaches up where we are.
Growing season is long.
We're already getting a mixture of the polar bear and the grizzly bear.
Yes. But the evidence is everywhere. It's just, you just can't get away from it. Every day there's more things in the news, things that are changing, and not necessarily for the good. Yeah.
Well, I felt very strongly with your last statement that, you know, made me feel good that in a million years we're not going to be here. We're not going to be here even if we're successful in what we're talking about right here. And plants come and go. They, you know, maybe some gymnosperms have been around for a gazillion years, but they won't be here forever either. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, it is a natural process. You know, it could be that it's our nature to do this. I mean, that's the downside, that we will just poison ourselves off the planet, which is sort of what I think. That's maybe just in the nature of evolution.
When you think of the history of life on Earth, I don't know whether you've ever seen this particular example. Would you stand up?
Yeah, all right.
I won't ask you to do anything else. Sketch your own side. Okay, if this represents 3.5 billion years ago when the first life appeared on the planet, these would be unicellular organisms, one-celled organisms, very tiny, very primitive. Right about here is where oxygen began to accumulate because photosynthetic one-celled organisms began to appear. Then you go on down. Somewhere right about in here is where multicellular organisms occurred. Right here. Then you get the explosion. The Cambrian explosion comes here. Then there are these mass extinctions. And right out here, here's man.
The fingernail.
So, we have an exaggerated... You can sit down. We have an exaggerated opinion of our own importance in the grand scheme of things.
Who needs a blackboard?
That's right.
But on the other hand, we're the first species that can see what's wrong and can do something about some of it.
And the first species to mess it up that bad.
Right. So maybe we should be writing a handbook for the next successful species.
That's a good thought.
The question, though, is how do you predict? And Darwinism is not a very good predictive theory, is it?
No. Well, it's very predictive.
Well, what will happen?
It doesn't predict what will happen. It predicts what you can expect given certain conditions. We can't predict the future. We can influence the future, But I mean, what the predictable part of Darwin is, like, for example, in the fossil record, you expect to find transitional, like, for example, we know that fish were present. I'm not very good about remembering how many years ago, but you didn't have land vertebrates present. So you would predict that somewhere in that space between those two kinds of fossils, you'd find something that was in transition, something that was fish-like and land-like. And that's what happens. I mean, that's over and over again, that kind of... So it's predictive in that way.
All right, well, it's finally explaining the past, but it's much more difficult to predict the future. But by Darwinism, astrophysicists don't have any trouble. They know about the evolution of the solar system.
They know we're going to blow up.
Yeah,
just blow up.
But yeah. Biologists have a much harder time.
Well, it all depends on the environment. Changes that take place in the environment, some of them natural, some of them man-made, and who survives depends on who's best adapted to.
Yeah, I think the answer is you can predict pretty accurately in a very, very general ways on how systems will change. But the specifics are essentially unpredictable because everything's so complicated. In ecology in general, we're talking about the biggest view of ecology really is in evolution is part of that. So the specifics of what's going to happen when you stress an ecosystem are totally unpredictable. There are millions and millions of different details that might happen.
Because
there's
an S variable.
No,
you could even have another S
variable. However, if you can describe the predictions in a very general way. For example, you have a good example among animals is think about is muskrat ecology, population ecology. The normal ecology for muskrats here in the Midwest and their very pothole country is about 10 years, I think, of more or less stable populations, and then a sudden population explosion in which the muskrats eat everything in sight, all the plant food that they eat. They completely destroy their habitat. The population explosion may be about 9 or 10 times the number that normally would be sustainable.
The carrying capacity. Mm-hmm.
Carrying capacity, the habitat. And what happens is that they flee their marshes because there's no longer anything to eat there. They're all starving in the fall. They all disperse, and about 9 out of 10 die. During that time.
And the plants come back.
One can predict when there's a population explosion in any species, some sort of scenario of that sort. Their habitat and there's some sort of a crash. And so there's a lot of generalities like that. It's very hard to predict.
If the muskrats have atomic weapons, it'd be even more uncertain.
I thought that one of the most, I guess, profound things is you gave this talk, not you, I think Stefan did, at Stevens Point about all this things going, and Bill Hitler just simply said, so what? So what? If it all goes to hell and if it all, the planet heats up, so what?
Well, I puzzle over that too, and we're going to be talking about this issue with the life group. So what? Well, for us, it probably doesn't make, you know, what's going to happen if the predictions are as dire as they say they are. It's not going to bother us too much. But we have children, we have grandchildren, and more than that, I hope we have a concern for everyone else's children. And more than that, as you point out, all these other species, they don't deserve to go down with us if that's the ultimate. So you do what you can, I guess, and speak out. But
it's a wondrous, beautiful world, and we like to keep it.
Yeah. There's, you like kind of like Paul Ehrlich, you know, he he likes analogies, and he was saying it's a ball game, and man's been hitting nature pretty hard, and it's coming up to the ninth inning, and in the last of the ninth, nature is bringing its heavy hitters up: global warming, rising seas, deforestation. These heavy hitters are coming up. Nature bats last, and it owns the park.
We were talking before about change agents, and a lot of people that don't understand very much about medical science have been helped a whole lot. I mean, they go and see the doctor without knowing anything about why, and they get helped a whole lot. And some of them that don't even want to believe in medical science when it comes to an extremity, why there's, you know, give me a few of them hold out and we take them to court for their kids, but by and large, most people, when it comes down to it, they go to, you know, go to see our cohorts, they try to do what, they don't understand anything more about medical science than they do about the theory of evolution, but
upon which medical science is based.
Yeah, that's, to a large extent. That's the irony. All these creationists, they're quick to go to the doctor and use all these drugs that are all based on evolutionary development.
Harrison Keeler said that God was a baseball fan because the Bible starts out in the beginning.
Oh, jeez.
Beginning. Yeah.
Did you want to say anything about court cases over the years?
Yeah. Well, we could talk a little bit about court cases.
The whole wedge thing. And,
yeah. I'll just very quickly mention, probably you know some of this or most of it. The Scopes trial in 1925 was the case where the state of Tennessee had the Butler Act had passed the Butler Act, which said no banning the teaching of evolution in public schools. And John Scopes read from the biology textbook Evolution, and he was hauled into court. It was really a publicity stunt because the people of Dayton, Tennessee, the town fathers, I guess, wanted some press. And so anyway, that famous case, and Scopes was convicted. He was later... the case was thrown out on a technicality. So the constitutionality of banning evolution in the public schools was not settled until 1968 in Epperson versus Arkansas. Arkansas had a similar law on the books banning the teaching of evolution, and this case went all the way to the Supreme Court. It was a unanimous decision that it was unconstitutional to ban evolution in the public schools. And then the next, that was the...
So they changed their tactics.
The creationists changed tactics, and then they enacted what's called the balanced treatment strategy, that if you're going to teach evolution in the public school, then you must also teach the creationist point of view. And so there was a case called Edwards v. Aguillard, which was decided by a 7-2 decision in the Supreme Court, which found that balanced treatment was unconstitutional. And I can't remember who, one of the two was Scalia, and I forgot who the other one was. It voted the wrong way.
Noted Thomas.
Yeah.
Thomas.
Yeah.
Did it have anything to do with, what was I going to say?
Never mind.
Okay. And then, of course, the most recent one is the Kitzmiller versus... Changing tactics again, the Dover Area School District in Pennsylvania. And this was teach the controversy. And so they insisted that in all the science classrooms, a statement, a disclaimer, be read to all the students that evolution is only a theory. And so anyway, that case... was decided by Judge John Jones, who was appointed by George W. Bush. See, he was a Republican, conservative, strict constructionist, and he wrote a withering opinion on this, that it was just, I don't have it in front of me, but you can go on the internet, and it's really quite... So the And this was, what they did was they changed the terminology from creationism to intelligent design, but it's essentially the same thing. And as I think I mentioned a little while ago, the new strategy, I think that the creationists were, you're knocked down considerably after the Kitzmeller case, but the new strategy seems to be on this academic freedom tactic. There has just recently been a law passed in Louisiana. It's called the Louisiana Academic Freedom Act of 2008, signed by Governor Bobby Jindal,
who's an up and coming,
and who took. Yeah, I mean, he had a good education. And I forgot now who was his biology professor in college.
Couldn't believe it.
Yeah, but anyway, it's the idea that. To teach the evidence against evolution. I guess the idea is if you find some arguments against evolution, then that brings the credibility of creationism up. The Discovery Institute, which is based in Seattle, they developed what's called the wedge strategy, and they have a real agenda. I think they have a short-term and a long-term plan to promote a creationist agenda centering on intelligent design. And their ultimate goal, stated goal, is to defeat the materialistic worldview in favor of a science consonant with Christian and theistic convictions to affirm the reality of God. So
I think they're the ones that do the creation museums.
Yes.
Yes. Oh, well, yeah, then there's Answers in Genesis, and I'm not sure whether that's exactly the same organization, but I don't know whether any of you have ever been there, but I guess it's quite.
Are you familiar with what she's talking about? The Creation Museum.
Creation Museum. It's somewhere in the outskirts of Cincinnati.
Kentucky.
Yeah.
Does a mix of religion and politics enter into this?
Oh, sure.
Well, I guess it always does, yeah, because...
Well, they're not supposed
They go politically through it. They use local governments, which happened in Dover. 40 Days and 40 Nights is my favorite book about that.
Yes, it's a wonderful book.
It really shows that the people that they got to run the conferences are not very nice people.
Yeah. But can it turn, do you think, with Obama being president now?
Well,
to
let's hope.
Back on.
I mean,
he has a very conservative Supreme Court.
Yeah.
And he's not real good on faith-based initiatives. So he's,
but he has made a statement about this administration is going to be based on science.
Right. Yeah.
Which I think is a step in the right direction.
And he did do away already with the gag rule.
Yes.
Which was very, very.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
but you know, it's one or the other. He's got the stuff about saying the faith-based initiative office will still exist, but he's doing a few science things, which makes it good.
And it takes time to change all this too.
He did recognize the existence of non-believers in this
country.
Yes, he did. I think that's the first time I've ever heard that in a public statement.
Yeah. And he did in one of his speeches quote Thomas Paine. Repeatedly, which I thought was really, really wonderful.
Yes. Uh-huh. Yeah, there were some encouraging things, certainly.
Thomas
Paine.
Who was the dirty little atheist, you know.
My hero.
Yeah.
I'd like to comment on that poll that you read at first. Mm-hmm. And I'm not at all surprised that those numbers are like they are. In fact, I'm surprised they aren't more swayed toward religion, because that's the way most of us were raised. And, you know, I went to engineering school, and I took biology in high school, and half of that was driver's ed, and so I never really, you know, it takes a lot of effort to go against what everybody else says and what your parents have taught you, and it's very easy to just simply say, well, there's a God, and that takes care of it.
But also the way
you have to go the other way.
How it's phrased is...
I mean, the majority of those polls are phrased so that people are going to say they believe in God.
But even if they phrase
no matter
right,
how
it's still,
that
means,
yeah. They have to redo them in a better way before I had to leave the evidence.
Mm-hmm. It's not easy to break away from what everybody else is saying, what your parents are saying, and what the government once in a while says.
I want to point out that the Christian right has had a very effective program, not just a campaign, but a program of training Christian right people up to the point of graduate degrees, and then placing them in high positions in government. And the Bush administration, of course, has gone right along with that and has appointed a large number of these people throughout the government in very important decision-making positions.
Yeah.
And one of the things that the Obama administration is going to have to do is to start to remove those people and replace them. But it's going to take a while.
Let's hope that they will be a large contingent of the unemployed.
There's an interesting book that perhaps I'm going to read called The Family. It's about this Christian conspiracy. And it really is a conspiracy. These people, they work underground, they work at the highest echelons of government, these national prayer breakfasts.
Yes.
Important people who would be afraid not to go because they're politicians, and I trust that some of them, like Hillary Clinton, can resist the irrationality of some of this, but they're a very powerful group, and they're closely aligned with the Campus Crusades and these things that are happening. So that's a very worthwhile book to read.
But it's exactly the thing that the Christians are saying about liberals. They say they worm their way in, and there's a conspiracy, and it's all trying to get up in higher ranks of government. So you turn that around, and you can write a book the other way.
Well, look at all the defectism result from getting these guys to advanced ingredients. Maybe we'll win just by that. They're creating defectives by putting these guys through school.
Surprising number of people can go get advanced degrees without having their own thing.
Well, Jane, do you have any concluding words?
Well, I do have one concluding quote that I thought maybe is worth sharing. This is an old book called Blueprints, written by Maitland Eddy and Donald Johansson. Johansson was the discoverer of Lucy. And this book is really a good book for a non-scientist to read. It kind of traces the history of biological science. And anyway, he ends
the genetic side.
Yeah, genetics and evolution. And he ends in his last chapter about is there. It's called "Is There Danger in Being Too Smart?" If we blunder along, getting ever more numerous, dirtier, and madder, we probably will not survive very long. Whether, to paraphrase T.S. Eliot, we go with a nuclear bang or a poison whimper will not matter. Either way, an observer from another planet would have to concede, along with Darwin, where he's sitting here too, that intelligence was just another specialty that ran out of control. Like every other highly specialized organism, man carried his specialization too far. In the end, his brain, which seemed like such a safe and liberating development, did him in. Intelligence, one small blip among millions of other specializations that have wrinkled the line of life, turned out to be just that, one small blip. In its day, it may have shaken the earth, as dinosaurs did, but when the big challenge came, change or go, it went. Darwin will have been right, after all.
Thank you very much, Jane.
Thank you so much. Oh, you're welcome.
Thank you.